From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A federal court just says no to congressional representation for 500,000 people, the residents of the District of Columbia. We'll speak with D.C. Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton. As President Clinton continues his trip through India, we'll talk with the retired head of the Indian Navy about nuclear weapons. We'll also go to Pakistan and Bangladesh. And as gas prices soar, a look at the alternatives. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. It didn't take long for the next step in the custody fight over 6-year-old Elian Gonzalez. Hours after a judge dismissed a lawsuit seeking to keep the boy in the United States, the ruling was appealed to the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta. In Tuesday's ruling, U.S. District Judge K. Michael Moore threw out the lawsuit filed by Elian's great-uncle in Miami. The judge said that, quote, each passing day is another day lost between Juan Gonzalez and his son. Moore said matters of asylum were strictly the province of the Attorney General. In Washington, Attorney General Janet Reno said she will consult with other Justice Department officials on how to reunite Elian with his father in a prompt and orderly way, but she did not set any deadline. Justice Department officials have made clear they want to avoid any steps that would traumatize the boy or provoke a confrontation with Miami's large Cuban exile community. The Supreme Court yesterday dealt a sharp blow to the Clinton administration's efforts to curb smoking, ruling 5-4 that the Food and Drug Administration had never received authority from Congress to regulate tobacco products. The decision, rejecting rules proposed by the agency in 1995 to restrict the marketing of cigarettes to children and teenagers, hands the question of national tobacco regulation back to Congress. The ruling was notable for the strong language that both the majority and the dissenting opinions used in describing the dangers of smoking, which causes some 400,000 deaths a year in the United States. The Adams Mark Hotel chain yesterday settled the largest race discrimination case ever brought by the Justice Department against the hotel industry by agreeing to pay millions of dollars to African Americans who said they were discriminated against during a reunion last spring and by hiring a monitor to ensure reforms take place. Attorney General Janet Reno said the $8 million settlement, which also includes a contribution by Adams Mark to four historically black colleges in Florida for scholarships and hotel management internships, sets a new standard for the entire hospitality industry to meet. A federal investigation of the St. Louis-based chain found that in upscale Adams Mark hotels, black customers were forced to pay more than whites for comparable accommodations and were kept out of hotel restaurants and lounges because the chain had a corporate strategy that too high a percentage of blacks in those settings was bad for business. James Hampton was killed by the state of Missouri at 12:05 Missouri time this morning at the Potosi Correctional Center. Hampton did not seek any final appeals of the death sentence. 18 death penalty opponents protested outside his execution. Meanwhile, Tennessee is preparing to execute its first prisoner in 40 years and fall in line with the rest of the South, where more people are executed than anywhere else in the nation. Tennessee is the only Southern state that has not executed anyone since the U.S. Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty in 1976. Robert Coe, who is 43 years old, is scheduled to die by lethal injection early tomorrow for kidnapping, raping, and murdering an 8-year-old girl in 1979. Coe's attorneys contend he's insane and that executing him will violate the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. Appeals have failed, and a federal judge will likely decide today whether to delay execution to review claims about Coe's mental competence. This news from Los Angeles. Former Secretary of State Warren Christopher has rejected a request to lead an independent investigation of the Los Angeles Police Department's widening corruption scandal. Los Angeles City Attorney James Hahn nominated Christopher for the task in a letter he sent yesterday to L.A. Mayor Richard Reardon and the City Council. But Christopher, who investigated the LAPD after the 1991 Rodney King beating, declined the request, saying the police commission should be allowed to do its job before an independent investigator is put in place. Hahn had charged that recent squabbling between Police Chief Bernard Parks and District Attorney Gil Garcetti jeopardized the internal probe and demonstrated the need for an independent investigator. And finally, this news from Philadelphia. In an extraordinary step, a special committee of women will help city police classify sexual assault complaints to make sure crime statistics are accurate and cases don't fall through the cracks. Under the new program, Women Organized Against Rape, the Women's Law Project, and other groups will oversee the police investigators and supervisors evaluating complaints. The Philadelphia Inquirer reported last year that the city police sex crimes unit put thousands of sexual assault complaints, almost a third of its caseload, in the, quote, investigation of person category, which kept the cases out of city's official crime tally. Investigators said the practice was a result of a steep workload and pressure to keep crime statistics down. The practice was not revealed to the public or to crime victims.
Move on, move on, move on with a freedom fight. Move on, move on. We're fighting for equal rights. Don't you stumble, brother, don't you falter. Oh, mother, don't you weep. We're marching on to our freedom, although the road is steep. Move on, move on, move on with the freedom fight. Move on, move on, we're fighting for equal rights. And as we heard those brutal words, we didn't turn around. But the water from the fire hose knocked us to the ground. And as we lay down on the
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to all of our listeners. And Amy, it happened again. Last night I was at Barnes & Noble and here in New York City at another reading on my book. And guess what one of the main questions was from a young, starstruck young man? What's it like to work with Amy Goodman? Now, Amy, I don't know what kind of hypnotic hold you have over our listeners, but everywhere I go, every city, people want to know what it's like to work with Amy. And of course, I told them you're charming and wonderful, and I couldn't bear to tell them about the whips you use on the producers or about the time you pinned Hulk Hogan after an interview, but
Errol, our engineer, you promised you would put Juan on the mic. That didn't work today, but we'll have to control you otherwise, Juan, after the show. Now to some more important news, though. Jameel Abdullah Olamine, the former Black Panther wanted in the fatal shooting of the Atlanta deputy, could be returned to Georgia as early as today. And some of you might be following this story. This is a story that unfolded over the last few days. He was found in Lowndes County, which is the site of so much civil rights activism in the 1960s. And Juan, he's been charged with fatally shooting Fulton County, Georgia, Deputy Ricky Kinchin and wounding Deputy Aldrennan English in the shootout in Atlanta last Thursday. The deputies were trying to serve Olamine an arrest warrant at a store, but you saw an interesting piece in that.
Yes, buried deep at the bottom of the New York Times account in today's paper is an amazing hole in this whole account, which is that the deputy English who survived the shooting insists that he fired on Olamine and that he wounded him. And in fact, there was a trail of blood leading from the shooting away from the shooting and leading several blocks away. Yet when Olamine was captured, he had no sign of a wound or an injury. So that would seem to indicate that there's a big hole in this entire story that will have to be sorted out as time goes on.
And we'll continue to follow that story. There's also an interesting piece in the New York Times today. It's a more than a half-page piece on Ken Sarawiwa's father, Jim Beeson Wiwa, who I got a chance to visit when Jeremy Scahill and I went to Nigeria in 1998. Ken Sarawiwa, the leading Nigerian activist who fought against Shell in Ogoniland and ultimately was executed by the Nigerian regime, and many felt with the involvement of Shell Oil. oil. Well, there's a profile on his father. It's called Not for a Nigerian Hero, The Peace of the Grave. And I just have to say, as is typical of the New York Times when it comes to covering oil corporations, for which they do almost ad-like massive pieces. They did one for Mobil, they did one for Shell, and they did one for Chevron and their involvement in the Niger Delta. This piece, there is almost not a mention of Shell at all. Objectively, this could not be possible when describing Ken Sarawiwa and all his work before he was executed. I think I saw two mentions of Shell. The New York Times should clean up its act when it comes to the involvement of oil companies in Nigeria, not only in terms of environmental devastation, but in terms of involvement in the killing of Nigerian activists. Well, we're going to turn right now to the first main subject of the day. This week, a federal court panel ruled that district residents, that's District of Columbia residents, do not have a legal right to a vote in Congress, dealing a blow to a coalition of community leaders and political activists who hope their arguments about fairness and democratic principles would help overturn 199 years of federal tradition. In its 2-1 decision, the panel acknowledged that it's an inequity that D.C. residents may not choose voting members in Congress as residents of the 50 states do. But the court majority said the Constitution and Supreme Court have created a precedent for that inequity and that those seeking voting rights for the district should turn to the political process, not the courts. Well, the issue of D.C. congressional representation and home rule has made its way into the presidential election season. In a TV interview last month, Texas Governor George W. Bush expressed his position against full voting rights and statehood for the district. He said, "I remain concerned about the district's education system and the fact that many of its agencies continue to remain under the supervision of the courts." He added, "Because I respect the design of the framers of the Constitution that our nation's capital remain independent of any individual state, I do not support statehood for the District of Columbia." We're joined now by two people who are involved in these lawsuits that were dismissed by the federal court this week. Eleanor Holmes Norton is with us, delegate from the District of Columbia, has been involved with the case Alexander et al. And Daley et al., which wanted the court to order Congress to find a way to let D.C. residents to elect full senators and representatives. George LaRoche is also with us, the lawyer for the Adams et al. Versus Clinton et al., which wanted the court to make it possible for D.C. residents to choose statehood or unite with another state like Maryland. Eleanor Holmes Norton, your first reaction to the decision?
Well, the court said it wasn't an inequity. It's more like a monstrosity when a court says that the fact that 500,000 people have no representation in the Congress is something they can't do anything about. Fortunately, one judge thought that the courts could do something about it, and it is on his opinion, the dissenting opinion, that we have pinned our hopes for a favorable decision in the Supreme Court. We will certainly appeal to the Supreme Court. Nobody could let this opinion lie standing as it is. We, of course, are pursuing our rights in many different ways, and of course have always pursued our rights in the political arena, but it seemed clear to us that modern constitutional theory was ample backing for a positive decision here. We did not get it. We will try to get it in the U.S. Supreme Court.
And in terms of this attempt by the court to basically pass the buck over to the Congress, now clearly the Democratic Party has always, as I understand it, has had in its platform the enfranchisement of all of the residents of the District of Columbia, but really you haven't seen much effort on its part to really press this matter very much, while the Republicans, of course, are adamantly opposed to it. Do you think that there is a much greater chance continuing up the ladder in the Supreme Court rather than pressing the political battle within Congress?
No, I wouldn't say that we had a glorious chance either way. But remember, the District of Columbia was without self-government for 100 years and didn't get it again until 1974. We don't intend to go that long, I must tell you, before getting voting representation in the House and the Senate. It is certainly true that the political process has turned a deaf ear, whether Democrat or Republican, although Democrats strongly favor voting rights. And it ought to be said that I was able, for the first time in the history of the United States, to get a vote on statehood in the Congress in 1993. And I got 60% of the Democrats, which is a large majority for any bill in Congress. I got one Republican and 60% of the Democrats. So it does seem to me that there is a clear difference between the parties on this score, but that when it comes to something as momentous as adding a representative and two senators, you always need greater bipartisan support than the district has ever been able to get.
George LaRoche is also with us, attorney for one of the lawsuits, Adams versus Clinton. Can you explain the difference between the two suits that were brought together and then dismissed by this panel?
Well, the other suit is based upon a very brilliant law review article asserting that there is such a thing as a fundamental right to vote implicit in the Constitution and in the American system. And the case is framed to vindicate that fundamental right to vote. The case I filed comes from a completely different position, is not based upon the right to vote, which we agree there is such a thing. Our case is based upon a more traditional theory of equal protection of the laws or equal standing before government. It's framed in many ways in the same way as the voting rights cases in the 50s and 60s in Brown versus Board of Education. You said a little bit ago that the majority opinion Monday said that the Constitution and the courts have created a precedent for exclusion of the district from the American system, essentially carving out a unique status for it. That's true. They have carved out that status, but anyone can crack open the Constitution and take a look at the plain language. It's obvious that the district is not unique under the Constitution. A lot of people are aware that originally the District of Columbia was 100 square miles, and a third of that was carved off and given back to the state of Virginia in 1846. Presently, that's the location of the city of Alexandria. The Pentagon is located within that area. Here you have two discrete areas with two discrete populations, which at one time were under exactly the same clause of the same sentence of the Constitution. Congress had absolute power over both of those. Yet today, all of the people who live in that former portion of the District of Columbia are citizens of a state, and they have all of the rights that a citizen of a state has. They can vote for state government. And a congressman cannot come along and say, we don't like the fact that you want to use marijuana for medical purposes, so we're going to just trump your decision to do that. Not as well known as the former portion of the district are what are called federal enclaves. Congress governs federal enclaves under the second clause of the same sentence in the Constitution. There are over 5,000 of these places. They're scattered throughout the United States. It's estimated that over 25 million people live there. And what's not well known is that 50 years ago, the people who lived in those places had no rights of citizenship. They did not vote for members of Congress. They did not vote for state governments because in the eyes of the states, they were residents of places over which Congress had exclusive jurisdiction. Congress changed their status, so they are now citizens of states. In a full sense, not in a partial sense, not in a for limited purposes sense. So what we did is we went into court and we said, simple question. You have separate discrete populations which are under identical powers of Congress. Why does Congress single out the district and treat it differently? What's stunning to us about the opinion that was issued Monday, out of 160 pages, of three cumulative memoranda, you can put every reference to the suit I filed on six pages. And four of those pages, only four of those pages actually address an argument or claim in the case. And what they do at that point, we believe, is essentially attack a straw man argument.
George LaRoche, I'd like to ask Eleanor Holmes Norton, in the suit that you are most closely identified with, Alexander versus Daley, does the right to elect full senators and representatives also include the issue of actual statehood or affiliation to another state?
It certainly doesn't include statehood, but it says that the district, as a matter of equal protection, is entitled to the same representation in the Senate and the House as other Americans. It is, in fact, grounded in equal protection theory. It is very important to remember that this suit or the position of our opponents essentially boils down to a section of the Constitution which gives the Congress power over the nation's capital. Well, that was of course a part of the original Constitution. Well, we fought a civil war in the last part of the 19th century and added the 14th Amendment. That's where you get the Equal Protection Clause. And one would think that one would have to read what Congress can do to the district in light of the mandate now for equal protection. It is very difficult to understand how any part of the Constitution written before the 14th Amendment could allow the district to remain in the same position it was when there was no equal protection clause. And so we think that the decision is wrong. And I recognize that the Supreme Court is not viewed as a conservative court. In many ways, it is a court that is not always predictable. But we will have to see whether there are five justices who are willing to sign their names to the proposition that there are any people on the planet who are not entitled to representation in their national legislature. If I could just say to you, I'm late now for a hearing. I've enjoyed being with you, but I've got to go.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. If people want to get more information, where can they call, Eleanor Holmes Norton?
Please call my office at 225-8050 here in the district.
That's 202-225-8050. Eleanor Holmes Norton, delegate from the District of Columbia. And George LaRoche, lawyer for Adams versus Clinton, the other lawsuit that represents more than 20 D.C. residents. George LaRoche, where can people get in touch with you?
The easiest way is through a website, www.dccitizensfordemocracy.org. That's DC Citizens for Democracy, as if it were one word, .org.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And when we come back, we'll be joined by the retired chief of the Indian Navy to talk about nuclear weapons. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Well, President Clinton issued a strong appeal to India today to put down its nuclear arms and reach out to rival Pakistan to restart peace talks. Earlier today, Clinton wrapped up his visit to New Delhi, capital of the world's most populous democracy, with an impassioned plea to India's parliament. He urged lawmakers to retreat from their nation's growing nuclear weapons program and reopen closed lines of communication with its nuclear neighbor. He said the former Soviet Union and the United States, despite their distance apart and elaborate set of safeguards, came far too close to nuclear war. Now the world's established nuclear powers are reducing their arsenals, he said, while India's marching in the other direction. This, we have to underscore, is being said as the U.S. Senate has yet to sign off on the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. Turning to India and Pakistan, Clinton said this week's bloodshed in the northern region of Kashmir, claimed by both India and Pakistan, quote, reinforces the need for dialogue. Although warmly applauded through other portions of his address, Clinton's comments on foregoing nuclear weapons and on overtures to Pakistan drew mostly silence from the chamber as he addressed India's parliament. And we want to also point out again, outside in New Delhi streets, protests are prohibited, despite the fact that people in other parts of India are planning major protests against Clinton when he goes to their areas. We're joined on the telephone now by Admiral Ram Dass. He is the retired chief of the Indian Navy and a fierce critic of nuclear weapons. Zia Min is also with us. He's professor at the Center for Energy and Environmental Studies at Princeton University. We'll first go to Professor Zia Min. Can you talk about the state of the nuclear weapons of both India and Pakistan?
Amy, I think that after the nuclear tests of May 1998, we are in that critical period now where the scientists who are responsible for the weapons programs in both countries are trying to push ahead with further research and development and try to actually put these weapons onto missiles and fit them as bombs onto aeroplanes. At the same time, there are command and control structures that are being announced and have been announced by Pakistan as to who would have control over the button if the weapon was actually to be used. And India has announced a nuclear doctrine as to how and when it sees its nuclear weapons being used and fitting into its larger security policy. So brick by brick, we're seeing them put into place all the institutional, scientific, technological, and military bases for becoming full-fledged nuclear weapon states.
Well, in terms of this, the impact of the Clinton visit on the Indian communities and on the the Pakistani nation, what do you think will be the impact of his visit on this continuing debate over nuclear weapons?
I think that the debate within India over nuclear weapons, everybody will take from Clinton's visit exactly what they want to take. There are people in India who think that India should have nuclear weapons to counter China. And they're saying, well, look, the U.S. is building a strategic relationship with us against China. So therefore, you know, we should do whatever the U.S. wants and the U.S. will support us. And look, it's turning over and stopping talking about India really seriously giving up nuclear weapons and saying we have our differences, so let's leave it at that. Those people who are wanting to push ahead with a completely autonomous Indian nuclear weapons and security program, irrespective of what the U.S. wants, have said, look, the U.S. has come, it's wagged its finger at us, but they're slowly lifting sanctions. There's nothing they can do about it, so let's just go ahead full steam. The people who are really going to be left out of this Clinton visit is actually the Indian peace movement, who have been arguing quite determinedly for years now, not just since the nuclear test, that India shouldn't have nuclear weapons and it should certainly never deploy nuclear weapons. What the president has said has given them little support, little succor. And in the future, I think things are going to become much more difficult for them because the Indian government at least will feel that they've now been blessed by the president's visit, that the tests have been forgiven. India has been accepted by the U.S. as a nuclear weapon state.
And what about in Pakistan, given the almost regular political turmoil within the Pakistani government and recent events there, the recent coup?
Well, in Pakistan, they know that basically they're going to be ticked off, as they would say, by Mr. Clinton. But having him there is enough since he was in India. They don't expect very much except for him to come there and to say, look, we're really concerned about the possibility of nuclear war, and especially over Kashmir, which is in part all that the Pakistanis want from the president right now, a recognition that things are serious and that the U.S., even though it doesn't know what to do, feels that something should be done. And as far as Pakistan is concerned, that's good enough right now, because that's part of what the larger policy is by especially the Pakistani military, to create a sense of crisis so that the international community will somehow find a way to intervene, because Pakistan and its military have not found a mechanism to push India into negotiations on Kashmir. So they're hoping that keeping the pressure on in Kashmir, keeping the threat of war, and especially nuclear war, simmering in the background will lead to the United States and the international community eventually finding some kind of way to get negotiations started. And just having the president come and say, I'm worried about it, is enough for them, at least for now.
We're talking with Zia Mian, professor at the Center for Energy and Environmental Studies at Princeton University. Now, what about the moral authority of the United States? Of course, we being the only nation that has ever used nuclear weapons on human beings, the moral authority of the United States and President Clinton to try to influence Indian and Pakistani nuclear policy?
There is no moral authority, and the tragedy of what's actually happened in India and Pakistan over the last few years is that for decades, India was actually one of the few countries that took a determinedly public moral position against nuclear weapons, that these things are genocidal, they're destructive, and even thinking about using nuclear weapons is an awful thing. But now, having tested their nuclear weapons, they've gone the same way as all the other nuclear weapons states have gone before them and consigned morality to the dustbin of history and pride themselves on basically being little clones of the U.S. I mean, the scientists there look up to the Los Alamos nuclear laboratory here saying this is what real scientists and real laboratories do. The soldiers think, well, look, you know, we have nuclear weapons, the U.S. has nuclear weapons, that will make us a great military power. And the politicians basically think the same way as U.S. politicians do, that having nuclear weapons somehow makes you somebody who can throw their political weight around. In the case of India, it will be in South Asia. In the case of the U.S., it's in the global arena. But the real fact of the matter is that when President Clinton goes to India and says, look, everybody else is walking away from nuclear weapons and India and Pakistan shouldn't start, the U.S. systematically refuses even to consider, for example, Russian demands that the number of strategic weapons that the U.S. and Russia have should be reduced even further to levels of 1,000 nuclear weapons, if not even further than that. And the U.S. Strategic Command, U.S. politicians, the U.S. president says, look, we need at least 2,500 deployed nuclear weapons on 15-minute hair trigger alert for U.S. security. I mean, on what basis then can you go and say that, look, the rest of the world is walking away from nuclear weapons? I mean, it carries no credibility. The Indian parliamentarians knew it. The Indian public who thinks about these issues knows it. And the rest of the world, when it watches President Clinton say these things, kind of nods wearily and say, yes, we've heard this before for the last 50 years about how nuclear weapons are really bad, but you guys show no signs of wanting to get rid of them.
You were just in the subcontinent 2 weeks ago, Zia Mian, as part of a big anti-nuclear conference. What does this visit mean of President Clinton for the future of the peace movement, even if it's excluded from the current visit?
It means that the peace movement in South Asia is going to have to work much harder, because now the government feels that it has legitimacy from the international community to keep its nuclear weapons and say, look, why are you people protesting? Nobody else is making such a big fuss about it. Perhaps you're not really patriots after all. And I think part of our struggle in South Asia, like the struggle of the peace movement in the United States, in Britain, in France, and in Russia, where the Russian government under Putin is giving anti-nuclear activists and environmentalists a really hard time, is that we're going to have to go through exactly the same kinds of tragic experiences, unfortunately for many decades, I fear, where we will be consigned to a political wilderness of slowly trying to educate people about just how terrible nuclear weapons are, how destructive the processes of making nuclear weapons are for local communities and their environment, and then hopefully over time that the international consensus against nuclear weapons, which is everybody else except these eight countries which have nuclear weapons, the United States, Russia, China, Britain, France, Israel, which nobody talks about, Pakistan and India, the rest of the world has renounced these weapons. And so we're going to have to make common cause with all the groups in all those other countries and basically form some kind of international coalition and alliance against the nuclear weapon states and their ruling classes, who just will not give up what they see as their mechanisms for domination in crisis.
And what about the impact on the rest of the Indian subcontinent about this continuing nuclear standoff between India and Pakistan? I'm thinking especially of Bangladesh and the enormous problems that Bangladesh has, but somehow doesn't quite get the world attention and certainly not the United States attention that it should to solving some of its fundamental problems.
Well, one of the reasons we had the meeting of peace activists in Bangladesh a couple of weeks ago that Amy referred to is precisely because we think that it's important for the neighbors of India and Pakistan, for Sri Lanka and for Nepal and for Bangladesh and others, to get involved and say, look, what do you people think you're doing? Right? That this is just not right. We have so many collective problems of poverty, of underdevelopment, that if we can't try and solve those together, you guys are just going to make every other kind of effort so much more difficult. And so, unfortunately, I think that part of the solution to underdevelopment and ending the awful suffering of well over a billion people in South Asia hinges on making peace between Pakistan and India. And we're trying to get people there to play some kind of role in helping develop a stronger civil society able to fight nuclear weapons in India and Pakistan, and to put pressure on their governments to pressure the governments of India and Pakistan to make steps forward on getting rid of their nuclear weapons. But having Clinton come there and say, well, look, you know, it's up to you to decide. We think it's a bad thing, but if you want to do it, there's nothing we're going to do about it because there's a market of a billion people there, which is really what this is all about. This is about Silicon Valley here and cheap programmers in India, and it's about the possible market of a billion people in India for U.S. products, and nuclear weapons be damned. And unfortunately, what we're seeing here is that the U.S. has said we're prepared to live with this because we can sell you things that will make us rich.
Well, Zia Amin, I want to thank you very much for being with us, professor at the Center for Energy and Environmental Studies at Princeton University. If people want to get more information on the peace movement in India, what websites can they go to?
There are many, many websites that are available to cover nuclear weapons in South Asia. I think the best place to start is probably a website that's called South Asians Against Nukes, which is www.mnet.fr, it's based in France, /AIINDEX, A index. And if anybody wants to, they can just search for South Asia Citizens Web, which hosts this website. So it's easily found.
Well, Zia Amin, I want to thank you for being with us, and we're going to list websites where people can get more information on our website at www.democracynow.org. And I also want to say we said today we would have Admiral Ram Dass on the program, retired chief of the Indian Navy. We were not able to get through on the lines in India. Each day we've had some trouble but have managed, and we did not get through today. But yesterday I was able to get through to Kani, which is right next to Bombay, to one of the leading peace activists in India. His name is Panchay Mangala Gopal, and he is co-coordinator of the National Alliance of People's Movements. And I asked him about the protests that were planned against this. This was an interview that I did yesterday afternoon as he laid out this week of protest.
We have protests on day after tomorrow, and tomorrow, in fact, everyday protests are going on as long as Clinton is in India. Tomorrow we are demonstrating in Thane. We are going to form a human chain, and we are basically demonstrating and asking Clinton to go back. And in Thane city, very recently, McDonald's shop has opened. So we are also demonstrating against that. So that is the kind of demonstration we are going to have tomorrow. That is on 22nd March.
Why are you demonstrating against McDonald's?
Yeah.
Why are you demonstrating against McDonald's?
We feel that McDonald's are trying to make the food as an industry. We are opposing to that. And we have a variety of food material available in India. Every local communities have their own food. McDonald's is trying to make whole thing as an industry, as a commercial thing, and it will uproot the local food suppliers in India, in Thane. Therefore, we are opposing it.
And what about the issue of Bhopal, Union Carbide, one of the work...
On 23rd March, we are going to demonstrate on Bhopal issue because 16 years back, this American Transnational Corporation, Union Carbide, in that company, the gas leakage has caused the death of more than 3,000 people. And it has affected permanent disability, some cancer and other diseases, in over 120,000 people in Bhopal. All very poor people staying in the poor hutments. So they are fighting for the last 16 years, and we are all from India are supporting their struggle for the last 16 years for the justice. The demand is that guilty are roaming free. It is shocking that Union Carbide Corporation, USA, and Warren Anderson, the two principal accused in the criminal case arising out of the industrial massacre, remain to be brought to justice.
Panchay Mangala Gopal, co-coordinator of the National Alliance of People's Movements, the major group, a coalition of more than 100 groups that is organizing protests throughout India. He is just outside of Bombay in Thane, where protests are taking place, and we'll talk more about those protests tomorrow. And in reference to both what he was talking about in terms of U.S. corporate involvement, Union Carbide, but also Zia Amin, when we come back from our break, we'll talk about briefly the list of corporate executives who have gone with President Clinton to India. But we have just been joined. We were able to reach Ram Dass, Admiral Ram Dass, who is the retired chief of the Indian Navy, and we'll speak with him as well about nuclear weapons. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
तेरे बिना तू कर डोलना शमा पिया तेरे बिना तू कर डोलना रो रख मैं दिवसरा तू कर डोलना शमा पिया तेरे बिना तू कर
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. We have an email from Corporate Watch, corpwatch.org, on the internet. And tomorrow we're going to go more deeply into the large corporate presence that is accompanying President Clinton and his family and aides. Behind the scenes, the first official visit to India by a U.S. president in more than 20 years. More than 50 U.S. corporate executives are meeting with Indian officials and business representatives. Among them are Frank Wisner, who is former ambassador to India, currently representing American International Group, IAG, one of the largest insurance companies in the U.S. Joseph Sutton of Enron, a Houston-based natural gas giant with projects in India. Peter Howell of banking conglomerate Citigroup. Dinesh Keskar of Boeing India. Boyd Montgomery of Unical. And Charles Sarris of Pfizer Pharmaceuticals, to name just a few. Again, tomorrow we'll be joined by Corporate Watch to talk about what this corporate delegation means. But right now, we're on the telephone with Admiral Ram Dass, who is speaking to us from just outside of Bombay, retired chief of the Indian Navy. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Admiral.
Hello.
Hello. It's good to have you with us.
Well, it's good to be there.
Well, when were you the chief of the Indian Navy?
When did I, sorry?
When were you the chief of the Indian Navy?
From 1990 to 1993.
Were you always a fierce critic of nuclear weapons?
Yes.
And could you tell us a little of why you reached that conclusion that nuclear weapons posed a danger to your country as well as the rest of the world?
Well, quite frankly, you know, India has always wanted and has taken the lead in nuclear disarmament for well nigh a half a century. And it was quite surprising, therefore, that our whole stand on nuclear weapons, although we were quite clear that we were capable, you know, the capability was demonstrated in 1974, but it was self-restraint and a deliberate policy not to weaponize. And everyone was hopeful in India that the nuclear five, you know, the top five or whatever you like to call them, the P5, would show some wisdom and do something about their commitments to the non-proliferation treaty in Article 6 and so on and so forth. But nothing seemed to happen, and that gave the new government here, when it came to office in 1998, to go ahead and, you know, bite the bullet, as it were, and literally set off these devices in May of 1998. And that was quite a shock to many people, because there was no strategic defense review and basic overall assessment of the situation before going in for this, which they had promised in their election manifesto and national agenda. This really was the real turning point in India's becoming and announcing itself to be a nuclear weapon state. Now, why do I consider it dangerous? Quite clearly, any nuclear weapon system requires a complete set of infrastructure, command, control, and various related systems, and have to be of a type which will ensure a lot of safety. Even in the very high technology level situations in countries like United States, erstwhile Soviet Union and now Russia and so on, we have had many near misses and almost as many accidents. So I think this is something which somebody who's joined the league, as it were, so late, must be very wary of. And also the continuing tensions that are prevalent in South Asia does make these things a little more dangerous to have as weapon systems. Does that sort of answer your question for the time being?
It does, for now and even beyond the time being. But I wanted to ask, after India tested nuclear weapons in 1998, and then Pakistan responded by testing nuclear weapons also, what has that meant for the Navy and for grassroots activists in India, where you are now?
Well, you see, in the initial stage, frankly, a great majority of people were not even aware what has happened. And you know, in remote areas of India, which is where really India's heart beats, many people didn't even know what had happened. And they thought another bomb, well, okay, it's another bomb, you know. The implications of it being a nuclear weapon hadn't quite registered. And only when the awareness dawned and people got more wary of it, that things are looking a little clearer. And also, I think the overarching reason was probably political, and really people hadn't quite understood what kind of ball game this is. And this is what is my feeling. But I think now there is generally greater awareness all around, and there are groups who are working actively to promote the awareness of the hazards of nuclear weapons, not only nuclear weapons, also basically nuclear energy, and all the accidents that they do tend to have and the lasting damage it does to people and environment and so on. And I think recent examples of Japan and South Korea, and where even powerhouses, power stations have had accidents, and fuel assembly ranges have had accidents. So there are a number of such things now slowly being made aware to our public and our people. And therefore, I think people are still very hazy, and why talk about our great majority, even the so-called educated and the so-called literate, haven't got a serious idea of what it all means.
What is your sense within the Indian military and the former colleagues of yours and in the officer corps, given the fact that India had been such a staunch opponent of nuclear weapons for so long? what is the sense within the career military establishment about this amazing change or about face in Indian policy?
It's much the same as what has happened to many generals and admirals in the United States, who, like Lee Butler, who's my sort of counterpart in the other end, and, you know, it doesn't make much of an impact, does it, on the political machinery? Look what your Senate did to the CTBT. They chucked it out of the window. So these are the kind of things which are not easy to, not easy to fathom and not easy to understand. But some of these people have built an aura and a shield around themselves and their thinking compartments, which prevents any kind of arrows to make any impact, at least for the time being. And that's the way I read it. You see, the military, once you are in uniform and serving, either you serve, and being a democratic system, as both our countries are, you serve, and you, if you don't find things are going right, you say thank you very much, and you quit, and then do whatever you have to do. And that is the situation.
Are you
and
concerned?
The leading, sorry?
Are you concerned that there could be a nuclear war between India and Pakistan, which would then be far?
Let me put it this way. There could be a nuclear war anywhere in the world where there are nuclear weapons. I don't think that it's any less of a chance with, say, whatever, if, you know, so Russia very recently were quite prepared to use a nuclear weapon. I mean, because they thought that they were being threatened. United States says that they will use the nuclear weapon in case they are threatened by a country like North Korea, which might have a missile. And your old program of national missile defense is a fallout of that kind of logic. I mean, the whole thing is weird, to say the least. So it can happen anywhere. But in this part of the world, when it happens, we don't have much reaction time. Unlike, say, a missile exchange between continental U.S. and, say, Russia or China and the United States, shall we say. So these are things which you have to see in perspective. But the threat, I think, of a nuclear weapon going off anywhere in the world is just as easy as it is in this part of the world. Okay, right now there is greater focus because the two neighbors are not lived like good neighbors, and we've had three wars, and since both of them have got weapons, naturally the risk is higher.
Admiral Ramdas, I want to thank you very much for being with us and glad we finally got in touch with you, retired chief of the Indian Navy, fierce critic of nuclear weapons, speaking to us from just outside of Bombay, where, in fact, President Clinton is headed. And now we're going to take the story of energy back to this country as we look at an action that that President Clinton did just before he left for India, and that is to dip into the oil reserves of this country as the cost of heating oil doubles to $2 a gallon, oil tripling to $30 a barrel. Consumers, policymakers, and energy experts are raising an issue that surfaced during the 1973 Arab oil embargo, the need for a new energy policy. According to advocates of a policy change, low prices and abundant oil supplies in recent years have dimmed public awareness of an energy crisis that, in fact, has never gone away. We're joined right now by Howard Geller, Executive Director of the American Council for Energy Efficient Economy. And we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Tell us your response to this rapid increase in the cost of gas and what you think has to be done.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head by indicating that we haven't had an energy policy in this country for the last decade or two. The focus today has been primarily on the supply side of the equation, what we can do to increase oil supplies here. Actions such as releasing oil from our strategic petroleum reserve, possibly opening up environmentally sensitive areas in Alaska to oil production, areas that have been off limits to the oil companies. We think that this is really the wrong focus. The root cause of the problem today has been our addiction to oil, our growing oil consumption over the last couple of decades, which is driven primarily by increasing number of cars and gas guzzlers that have been produced by the auto companies and purchased by consumers without any thought to fuel economy, and also the failure of our government to increase the fuel economy standards, which would force more efficient vehicles into production and into use.
Well, Howard, a lot of us are old enough to remember the early 1970s and the huge increase in oil prices back then as OPEC began to flex its muscles. And at that time, there seemed to be a commitment to reducing energy consumption, but of course that dissipated quickly. What is your sense of this? Of the ups and downs of this attempt of our government to rein in oil usage?
Right. After the first oil price shock in 1973, we took a variety of actions to address both the supply and demand side of the equation. Most important was the adoption of fuel economy standards on new cars and light trucks. Those standards, the so-called corporate average fuel economy, or CAFE standards, led to a doubling in the average fuel economy of new cars between roughly 1975 and the mid-80s. Around 1988, the fuel economy of new cars peaked 12 years ago. They've actually declined. The typical new vehicle today gets about 24 miles per gallon compared to about 26 miles per gallon back in 1988.
And, of course, a lot of that is the proliferation of sports utility vehicles, right, among American consumers and how the companies are pushing them?
That's correct. That's certainly a big factor in the equation, is the proliferation of these gas-guzzling sports utility vehicles.
What about biological-based alternatives? What is realistic for this year and the years to come?
Right. The potential is certainly there to replace oil over the long run with fuels produced from energy crops and waste materials from forestry industry and from farming, convert those materials into fuels such as ethanol. Today we're producing some ethanol from corn, which is a relatively expensive way to produce a fuel. The potential is there to take the woody materials, trees, and other woody materials, and use better technologies to convert those materials into fuels.
Is there government support for this?
There's government support. There should be additional government support. It's a promising area. It's still relatively expensive, although there's been a lot of progress in bringing down the costs. We need the continued research and development, and on this side of the equation as well, I think eventually we will need standards that will drive these technologies into production and into use to require that fuel producers purchase renewable-based fuels from clean bioenergy crops over time. We suggest a standard starting at 5% renewable fuel content in 2010, growing over time to get these fuels into production, to produce our fuels in the United States, creating jobs and income in the United States, and
Howard
cutting
Geller,
our oil imports.
We have to break for the end of the show. I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy. You can find them on the web at www.aceee.org. That's aceee.org. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love, Maria Carrion, Sputnik Colombi, and Karen Palmer. Errol Maitland is our technical director. You can write us by email, democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening.